most busted in Laredo, but for reasons that I'd rather not disclose.
I smoke pot, and I like it a lot. Hi, this is Willie Nelson. I learned a long time ago that marijuana is a lot safer to use than alcohol. There's absolutely nothing wrong with the responsible use of marijuana by adults. It's time we stopped arresting and started respecting responsible marijuana smokers in America. And to learn what you can do to help, please contact Normal at www.norml.org or call toll-free at 888-67-NORMAL.
The show was long and we were just sitting there, and we'd come to play and not just for the ride.
Distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is your daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular audio podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about the show at our website, normalaudiostash.com. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. Welcome back to Normal's Daily Audio Stash. Today, it is Thursday, October 4th. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. There's no better time to get involved with legalizing marijuana than right now. Make your donation or join Normal today simply by going to Normal's website at normal.org. That's N-O-R-M-L.org. In our news today, we're going to cover an important historical topic dealing with marijuana prohibition. 70 years ago this week, on October 2nd, the first people ever were arrested for federal marijuana prohibition. We'll have more about that in our news today. Also joining us today from Denver, Colorado, is the director of Safer Alternative for Enjoyable Recreation, Mason DeVert. Mason's going to talk about a new billboard ad that's gotten national attention for Safer in Denver. Also in the program today, we're going to have a little bit more of our Normal 2007 conference warm-up. In today's conference audio from last year, we're going to hear Ethan Nadelman's 2006 Normal conference speech. Ethan will be out at the 2007 Normal conference as well. You can still book your conference registration tickets, as well as tickets to the High Times Normal Stony Awards in Los Angeles, California, right up on Normal's website. We have links as well at normalaudiostash.com. All that here today on Normal's Daily Audio Stash. Make sure to download your free stash every single day. Let's get to our news. In our news today, a historical note on prohibition. As the fall foliage turns to golden reds and stunning colors on the slopes of the Rocky Mountains, Denver police and the FBI move in to make a drug sting at a small nondescript hotel called the Lexington. They rush in and quickly arrest two men, seizing two marijuana joints. While such tactics and actions are commonplace today, this raid took place 70 years ago. The date was October 2, 1937, and these arrests opened a dark chapter in American history, implementing a law that had taken effect that very same day, the Marijuana Tax Stamp Act. The two men arrested, Samuel R. Caldwell, an unemployed laborer, and Moses Baca, would become the first of the tens of millions of Americans arrested and imprisoned because of marijuana prohibition. Caldwell was the first person ever charged federally for selling marijuana, and Baca was booked for simple possession. For their newly defined crime, Caldwell was sentenced to 4 years of hard labor in Leavenworth Penitentiary, plus a $1,000 fine. Baca received 18 months incarceration. Both men served every day of their sentence. A year after Caldwell was released from prison, he died. The Marijuana Tax Stamp Act was passed by Congress after just 90 minutes of floor debate and was vehemently opposed by the American Medical Association at the time. Championed by the country's first drug czar, Harry Anslinger, the law and its proponents' characterizations of marijuana smokers were starkly racist, in ways that would shock a modern audience and never be accepted in a post-civil rights era. The propaganda of the time linked marijuana smoking to black jazz musicians and Mexican immigrants. The tax stamps themselves for marijuana were never for sale. The federal legislation was fully understood at the time to be used as a prohibition and not a regulation. Fast forward 70 years to today, and the Marijuana Tax Stamp Act has been ruled unconstitutional. In 1972, President Nixon callously ignored his own hand-picked presidential commission who recommended marijuana be decriminalized federally and instead allowed marijuana to be included into Schedule 1 of the Controlled Substances Act. That new form of marijuana prohibition has brought this country into the modern era of skyrocketing arrests and incarcerations. In 2006 alone, almost 830,000 Americans were arrested for a marijuana violation. The racist nature of marijuana prohibition enforcement remains in place today, as do most of the prohibitionist themes that many recognize as reefer madness, a nod to the now cult classic propaganda film that portrayed marijuana smokers as out-of-control psychotics who terrorize women. While the government propaganda has changed little, marijuana science and culture have deeply evolved. Today, tens of millions of Americans of every race and ethnicity smoke marijuana. 94 million of us, or about one-third of the country, have admitted trying marijuana, and teenagers today say that the unregulated plant is easier for them to obtain than government-regulated alcohol. Marijuana is now broadly recognized as America's largest and most profitable agricultural product, and more exceptionally well-cultivated, high-quality marijuana is being grown than ever before. The most important change in 70 years is the exhaustive scientific and medical research performed on the plant. They have shown some surprising properties, such as the fact that a lethal overdose is impossible, a rare property for anything considered a drug, and that a variety of debilitating medical conditions are alleviated or improved by smoking marijuana. And now we're finding that the individual chemical components unique to marijuana, called cannabinoids, have anti-cancer properties and may also offer a glimmering hope for Alzheimer's disease and other serious brain disorders. Marijuana has also been found to be only mildly addictive, less addictive than caffeine, far less addictive than alcohol or cigarettes. The arrest of Caldwell and Baca in 1937 is a profoundly important turning point for American democracy. Since that arrest, world wars have been waged, civil rights and greater women's equality gained, labor has dramatically changed, and more modern defining issues have been addressed, such as a woman's right to choose and the empowerment of the GLBT community. Yet the broad governmental oppression of a basic freedom to choose a recreational intoxicant or to choose a natural medicine has not just remained in place, but pursued with confusing vigor. Marijuana arrests now total a major portion of all arrests in the United States, far outpacing arrests for all violent crimes combined. And it all began 70 years ago this week at the Lexington Hotel in Colorado. Thus, the arrest of Caldwell and Baca make them somewhat unlikely patriots. Patriots not because of their particular life deeds, but patriots like the Japanese Americans put into concentration camps during World War II, or the African Americans who endured the basest forms of oppression for centuries. They're patriots because, like hundreds of millions of regular men and women in United States history, they had their lives and personal freedom sacrificed as the result of a criminal government policy. Marijuana prohibition will end. When this policy changes and freedom is upheld, the millions arrested, starting with Caldwell and Baca, should never be forgotten. More information about Samuel R. Caldwell and Moses Baca, the Marijuana Tax Stamp Act, and the history of marijuana prohibition is available at Normal's website at normalnorml.org. We have specific links to this content today at normalaudio-com. While federal marijuana prohibition enforcement began in Denver 70 years ago, the Mile High City is now home to a very progressive set of ordinances regarding marijuana. In 2005, Denver City voters passed a local initiative decriminalizing the possession of 1 ounce or less of marijuana by those aged 21 and older. Though city police have ignored the ordinance and arrested more and more citizens there, another ordinance has been put forward by the group SAFER, Safer Choice for Alternative Recreation. Last year, SAFER ran a statewide initiative, Amendment 44, that attracted a huge yes vote on the question of recreational marijuana decriminalization, but fell short of passage. Today, we're going to speak with SAFER's director, Mason Tevert, about a recent effort by SAFER that has garnered national media attention this week. Mason also serves with Colorado Normal. Mason, welcome back here to the Audio Stash today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
It's great to speak with you again, Mason. SAFER had a big media hit this week in the form of a new billboard advertisement that's discussing NFL player Ricky Williams. Tell us a bit about this new ad.
Well, basically, just to give a quick background, Ricky Williams is an NFL football player who has been suspended and punished repeatedly for simply using marijuana and testing positive for it. So he is filed to be reinstated in the NFL this week. So we put up a billboard right across the street from Invesco Field, which is formerly Mile High Stadium, that had an image of what looks like him in a Broncos jersey. And it simply says, "Ricky, come to Denver where the people support your safer choice." And we put it there because we think that the people of Denver agree that marijuana is safer than alcohol. They voted to remove all penalties for it. They don't think adults should be punished just for using marijuana. And Ricky Williams would probably feel right at home here. So we wanted to send that message to him that not only do the people here in Denver support him, but they also think that this NFL policy and needs to change.
And Mason, on the day you unveiled the billboard, there was a fair amount of local media who turned out.
Yeah, absolutely. This has really gotten pretty far, and what's so cool about it is that it's really reaching a lot of people in a fairly different audience, which being the sports audience that doesn't often hear about marijuana. Many people read the sports section and not the rest of the newspaper. So this thing has been on ESPN. It was mentioned on Jim Rome is Burning. It was on ESPN.com, SportsIllustrated.com, and so on. But we also had a number of local press people, and it's also been more of an overall general story on marijuana and marijuana policy that has run on CNN and MSNBC and a number of other places. So we're really excited that we're getting this message out there, and people are starting to hear this message that marijuana is less harmful than alcohol and actually having to think about it.
And how have the sports journalists and broadcasters out there treated this story?
It's interesting. I mean, obviously a lot of them are very pithy about it. Some of them have criticized it or are making fun of it. A lot of people just, still think in that way where they think that it's just unbelievable and so bad that Ricky Williams tested positive for marijuana, but yet they have no problem with players who abuse their wives and come back a week later, or players like our current running back here in Denver, Travis Henry. He has fathered 9 children with 9 different women, and I certainly don't have any problem with that, but the fact remains that he failed to pay his child support. A judge ultimately had to force him to pay his child support, at which time he borrowed thousands of dollars from the NFL team he had previously played for. And, no one seems to really care that much about that. No one's calling his character into question. And it just goes to show the hypocrisy and the double standard here in the NFL where, a guy chooses to use marijuana after the game instead of alcohol, and he's the demon, but we have no problem with these other players who are engaging in violent activities and other deadbeat activities, literally.
Now, Mason, we've seen a lot of sports players arrested for marijuana possession. Is this, sort of an unspoken thing? Sports players garner big salaries and a lot of media attention, and many are cannabis consumers.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the NBA is a perfect example of that. I think the New York Times at one point placed the number of NBA marijuana users at some high, like astronomically high percentage. I don't remember if it was 70 or 80%. But, you know, the NBA doesn't even test for marijuana because they know that these players use it, and if they did test for it, they'd have some serious problems in the league. And, you know, there's really no reason for them to be testing for marijuana. It's not like it's a performance-enhancing drug, at least not when it comes to sports. Maybe it is for other cultural things, but it's just really crazy that we're so up in arms about it, and that's exactly why we did this, to get people thinking about it, why it makes sense, and so on.
So, Mason, how have you seen the sports world respond to Ricky Williams specifically, and maybe other players using marijuana?
Well, you know, obviously a lot of people's concerns don't even stem from the marijuana so much as they do with his decision to do this. And Ricky Williams has been very out front about this from the beginning. He suffers from social anxiety disorder. He's incredibly introverted. He's suffered from depression and so on. He used to be a spokesman for Paxil, but he decided that he couldn't use Paxil anymore because he thought it had too many harmful side effects, and marijuana didn't have those side effects. And he basically qualifies as a medical marijuana user in California. And, you know, if he would rather come home after a game of getting beat up on the field and simply smoke a joint rather than have a cocktail or go out to the bar and have a drink, it really makes no sense for the NFL to have a problem with that. And, you know, a lot of these sports writers, some of them do agree, but others think that he has a responsibility. And we would certainly agree that to some extent he does, he is responsible for his actions. But it's just a question of whether the NFL is holding all players responsible for their actions. I mean, does the NFL grill players who may have used alcohol in college prior to being 21? I mean, of course not. It's you know, just accepted that alcohol is used. And if you look at NFL, it has a long tradition of not only being involved with alcohol, but promoting alcohol. I mean, look at the Bud Bowl, the Coors Light Twins. Coors is the official beer of the NFL. I mean, it goes on and on and on. And obviously, if you go to an NFL game, at every turn, they're trying to get you to buy a beer. So, there's just a lot of hypocrisy here. And the point of this billboard was to really shine a light on this and get people thinking.
Also, Mason, I want to discuss the ordinance today. There was some interesting activity with that new Denver municipal initiative that would make marijuana the lowest law enforcement priority in the city. But the city had a parlay with you on the ordinance in regards to the upcoming Democratic National Convention.
Basically, a little while back, you know, the city council here had been voicing quite a bit of opposition to the initiative we proposed. And to some extent, they really just seemed to have problems with the language, not necessarily with the concept. I mean, obviously, many were against the concept as well, but they really just seemed to think that, oh, this was an illegal initiative, which we all know is not true. The ACLU has taken a formal position that these lowest law enforcement initiatives are perfectly legal. But we simply said, you know what, if you don't like this specific initiative, why don't we do this? You all commit to researching and looking into a new alternative marijuana policy in our city, and we will withdraw this initiative. And, you know, obviously we wanted to make sure that they were sincere about that, so we suggested that they put a moratorium on marijuana citations during the Democratic National Convention to demonstrate their commitment to this. And they were, you know, up in arms over that, the notion that we could even work with them. I mean, they felt like we were, you know, they were God and we couldn't make a deal with them. But regardless, it got a lot of attention. The Washington Times did a story just about our message that, hey, you know, it's going to be a tumultuous time here in Denver when the convention comes through. There's going to be tens of thousands of people here that aren't typically here. They're all going to be very passionate and protesting. There's going to be demonstrations. There's going to be, people going to the convention. And you know what? Right now, the only legal drug that they're going to be able to use is alcohol. And this city has voted to allow adults to make the safer choice to use marijuana. And we would like to see, we'd like to take this opportunity to set an example for the rest of the country and show that, hey, maybe we would see fewer alcohol-related incidents if we allowed adults to use marijuana instead.
All righto, Mason. This has been a great discussion today. I really appreciate you taking time to join us here again.
Thanks so much.
Thanks again, Mason. Mason is the director of Safer Alternative for Enjoyable Recreation, Safer in Colorado. They can be found online at saferchoice.org, and we have links at normalaudiostash.com. Stay tuned. We've got Normal 2006 conference audio coming up for you next.
You're listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash.
In our warm-up to the 2007 Normal Conference, we've been playing some speeches and panels from the 2006 Normal Conference. Today we're going to hear Ethan Nadelman, the Executive Director of the Drug Policy Alliance, speak at the 2006 conference in San Francisco. Ethan will be on panels at the 2007 conference as well. There are still registrations available. You can link up at normalaudiostash.com. Here's Ethan Nadelman from the Drug Policy Alliance.
The reason I was down a little bit late was all of a sudden the phone's ringing. And the front page of the New York Times. And other papers. FDA dismisses medical benefit from marijuana, it says. Which FDA? Is that the Fraudulent Data Association? Is that the Fools and Dolts Alliance? I mean, this is, you know, must be the Vioxx folks, or maybe it's the morning after pill, or maybe it's the administration. Of course, it says there's no such thing as global warming, or that, you know, Iraq was. But I mean, I tell you what's interesting about this piece. Just reading this thing through on the front page of the New York Times, above the fold, right, is the next line, and here we can say to the New York Times, thank you. Political fight widens, it says. Agency reply to Congress contradicts 99 report by U.S. scientists, the Institute of Medicine. And this article is about the conflict that is emerging. Now, when you see something like this, I mean, the question is, what the hell is going on? What is going on at this point? Was it 2006? We already have the dozens of studies. You know, people say go to the National Institute of Health website and put in their medical cannabis, and hundreds of things pop up. You know, John Benson, the co-author of the Institute of Medicine report back in '99, who was very leery of any engagement with anybody involved in marijuana, medical marijuana reform, anything like that. Okay. You know, and he's saying this is nonsense. Never mind going back to 1988 and Francis Young and the administrative law hearings of the DEA, right? Never mind that fact. Never mind the fact that right now you have what ASA has this Data Quality Act thing in there waiting for a response, and the government keeps saying, well, we need more time because we need to come up with more evidence, and they're afraid they keep getting of independence about this sort of thing. But what you can see here, if you step back one step, two steps, three steps, what you see is this is sort of the craven last grasp, the craven last efforts of a fanatical administration that is obsessed with the issue of marijuana, obsessed with putting forward a not even paternalistic but authoritarian policy in this country. You know, who was part of the review hearing? Was it independent scientists? No, it was the DEA with government scientists. With government scientists, when you have government scientists already resigning because they can't stand the politicization. The politicization of science in this administration. You know, when John Walters came in, we knew right away. What did John Walters care about? Did he care about drug addiction? Not really. Addicts? No. Treatment? Only if it was coerced or involved God, very clearly on the front page. Right? Did he care about anything at all except the issue of marijuana and except the issue of drug testing our kids? Of trying to turn America ever more into sort of totalitarian-like vision of his right-wing notions. Where did John Walters work in between his stints in the drug czar's office? Did he work in the issue of health? Did he work? No. No. Where he worked was he went to head the organization of right-wing philanthropies, the philanthropy roundtable. Where did he get his training? At William Bennett's Little Me. Right? John Walters, William Bennett's mini-me, you know. Yeah, but you know, if you can't keep talking to me through every sentence, I won't be able to get a speech together here. How about you sit in the back, talk to the guy in front of you? That's okay. I know you're excited. You're excited. It's true. It's true. It's true. But step back another step, and you realize the extent to which this is a matter of weakness. This is an indication of weakness. You know, they know they're losing on this front. They see the numbers everywhere. They see the medical marijuana legislative efforts. They see how things are getting institutionalized and legitimized in California. When you see polls, you know, the poll that came out 2 years ago in Alabama showing 70% of people support legalizing medical marijuana, when the polls show a majority of Republicans supporting it, when those of us at MPP and Normal and DPA talking to folks on the Hill find more and more Republicans going, you know, we're really with you, and we, you know, we just wish we could say so, right? When you see that our co-sponsors of our legislation all around the country on medical marijuana are prominent Republican legislators who have personal experiences with cancer or MS or other diseases, what you see is that this group driving policy right now, they are not emblematic or typical of the conservative movement in this country. They are the radical fringe of that group. They are what you might call the John Birchers of the war on drugs. Right, you remember, you know, back in the 50s, the 1960s, right, when everybody was anti-communist, right, everybody was against communism. Then you had the John Birchers, who were beyond the pale. They were the ones who believed that the whole Russia-China conflict was just make-believe to kind of trick us into believing they were, right? I mean, they were the ones who were fanaticized. They were the ones who represented a tiny fraction. But they oftentimes did have political power. And what we see here today with John Walters and those folks are the John Birchers of the drug war, are the people who have no element of compassion on this thing and who understand. You know, it's the thing that George Lakoff, I think his name's mentioned before, you know, who wrote the book Moral Politics and the little book Don't Think of an Elephant or something. You know, the guy who's become sort of the new darling of intellectual progressive vision in America. And he made this point that somebody else put up yesterday about these two different visions of America. You know, the sort of nurturing vision, the one that we identify with progressives or what the compassionate conservative pretends to be about, right? And on the other hand, we have the authoritarian. Two models of parenting apply to society. And which one is going to win out? Now, we know the one that sits in the White House today, right, is the authoritarian one. It is the one that believes that they are, like authoritarian churches and theocratic, you know, administrations in the past, that they are the fount of authority. And that their role as government is to tell us citizens what the facts and what the truth will be, no matter what the science may say, no matter what the evidence may say. It means that people who don't go along with the official government gospel will be removed, will be asked to leave, will be pushed out, or will be put in a situation where they can no longer simultaneously stand up and act out on scientific ethics and work for the U.S. federal government. In a few days, the Drug Czar's office is going to be on its next leg of its tour promoting student drug testing in Milwaukee, right? One of my young associates, Jenny Kern, is going to be up, you know, there, all 23 years of her, you know, challenging the Drug Czar's reps and laying it out there on television and radio and organizing people around this, as we're doing all around the country on this thing. If you look at what's going on medical marijuana and student drug testing, what you see is that therein lies the true passion of this administration. Walters, you saw last year, all of a sudden, the Sheriff's Association, the National Sheriff's Association, lambasted John Walters. So why is he talking about marijuana? Usually sheriffs like talking about marijuana, but now they're freaked out about methamphetamine. For good reason, for pretend reasons, whatever. But between methamphetamine and marijuana, John Walters is this. So you can see he can't give it up. So he goes out there and he talks about methamphetamine. He talks about task force. He's always looking to find ways to put in there the need for coerced treatment and for more criminal sanctions and for more restrictions and all this sort of stuff. But we know where his passion is on this issue. We know what he really wants to be doing is going out there. He's afraid to condemn medical marijuana, right? John Walters will never have a one-on-one debate, nor will other members of the administration ever have a one-on-one debate on this issue. They are afraid. He's surrounded by phalanxes of people to keep him from being exposed to any counter-arguments. He dare not get within a mile's distance or shouting distance of a doctor, of a patient, or of a scientist. Flow in, hide, don't announce where you're going. Find a school that has just started doing student drug testing without cause. Give a little rah-rah speech. Quickly be whisked out to a meeting with the newspaper editors. No debate, please. Let's move on. Now, of course, almost nobody's heard of John Walters, too, except us. I have such mixed feelings about that. I mean, on the one hand, when McCaffrey was up there, you know, all over, flying around, mixing it up, or when Asa Hutchinson, you know, the one good thing about Asa Hutchinson, head of DEA, is he liked to debate. He was a politician. I'll debate, sure. I'll say anything. I want to get up there. Yeah. You know, John Wall, the nice side of that, of course, was that they kept our issue a bit in the news, and they gave us a chance to respond and respond and respond. And now you have John Walters there, and Karen Candy, Karen Tandy. God, how did I mix that one up? Karen Tandy, you know, you have them, but they don't have a public profile. One's a political hack. The other one's a law enforcement hack, right? They never in the newspapers. Well, the downside of that is we get fewer opportunities to mix it up with them because we know anytime we have a chance to mix it up with them, we take a step forward. The upside of that is it means that they have no voice and they have no plan. They have no voice, and they have no plan. And I think what's so beautiful about what happened this morning is it shows the desperation. It shows that they are trying to defend the position of a 20% minority of this country, maybe less at this point. Right? The more they dig in on medical marijuana, the more they dig in on an issue where the vast majority of Americans are on our side, the more opportunity we have to push forward and bring more people with us, right? If we're just fighting on the terrain of marijuana legalization where we only have 40%, depends where you are, less than that in the South, more than that in the West, you know, then, you know, they can keep playing on these fears and the issues that were put up there before and the ones that Chris Conrad rolled off in his speech, you know, all the potencies and this and that. But when they're playing on this terrain, when they're trying to say things which, you know, we found, in fact, that something like 1 out of 3, 30 to 40% of all Americans actually say that they know somebody who uses marijuana for medicinal purposes, right? That this is not some obscure thing, but people know somebody, right? What they're doing is basically saying, as the man caught in bed with his mistress by his wife said, who are you going to believe, me or your own lying eyes? That's where they're at now. That's where they're at. So this is the opportunity right now. This is the opportunity. Now, what I want to know, of course, is how do you all think about how we're going to move this thing forward to another level, right? We know. Excuse me one second. We know that whenever the patients are put forward, we win. We know that. We've seen it. It just keeps building. We know, and I think there's something of a consensus in this movement now, right, that we have to keep pushing medical marijuana forward around the country one way or another. Why? Because every opportunity we have in state legislatures and the media to put patients and doctors up there, all the work that the organizations here that ACE is doing with its increasingly national network and MPP and Normal and DPA and the state-based organizations and SSDP and everybody else, that every time that happens, we move forward, that we advance. The more the patient, and the more we do that also, the more we change the nature of the debate. The more we shift the debate over marijuana from what about the kids to what about the people who use this as medicine. The more we shift this thing into a more of a compassionate vein and away from the fearful vein. We know that. We also know, and I believe, that California, I think the chances are that if marijuana is ever going to be legalized, I mean, this is an interesting question here now, you know, with MPP doing the initiative in Nevada and the numbers beginning to creep up to 50% there and looking at what might happen in Alaska and the little victory that Dominic just described. But I sometimes think that maybe where it's really going to happen is in California. And here's why. Here's why. It's not that the public opinion numbers in favor of legalization in California are quite as high as they are in some other places, but it's that if you ask where in the world is marijuana now sold more openly, more legally than anywhere outside the Netherlands, there's only one answer. California. California. How many medical MCDs, medical cannabis dispensaries, we're going to call them, how many of those things exist in California now? 37. How many statewide? 219? 219 cannabis dispensaries, living in a little bit of fear, never knowing if somebody might come in and the feds might come in, living in a situation not unlike the Dutch coffee shops lived in the early 1980s. You know, they weren't legal either. They weren't authorized under laws yet, right? Some of them would get poked on and shut down, some of them because they weren't playing by rules. But more and more, they were becoming legitimized. They were becoming legitimized, right? When you look at what's happening now, when you look at the people with the ID cards, when you look at doctors who are going along this, hundreds, thousands of doctors, right? We have this happening in the other states, of course, in Oregon and Washington and Hawaii and Nevada and other ones as well, right? But what we have here is, what, 100,000 people? Over 100,000 people now, and more coming on in a legitimized way, in a state where even your governor and the former other Republican candidate also say people should be able to use marijuana legally for medicinal purposes. I think that if we start asking the question where and how is this going to happen, the question to be asked is the medical cannabis dispensary approach, is that the one that's going to get institutionalized, legitimized, regularized, in part because it's going to submit to regulation and to everything that that involves and make the compromises that are involved. And because then when you go back and you ask the public, what is it that you're really scared about, rationally speaking, about making marijuana legal for everybody, for all adults? Oftentimes what we found in our research is what people say is, I don't want it to be out of control. I don't want it to be out of control. And we respond very rationally. Well, you don't want me out of control. Keeping it illegal, prohibition makes it out of control, you know? I mean, prohibition pretends to be the ultimate form of regulation when, in fact, prohibition represents the abdication of regulation, right? But then they come back and they go, yeah, I see what you're saying. That makes sense. But still, I mean, making it legal still seems like it's getting out of control. Right? So the intellectual argument is there, but now there's another vehicle coming along, which are the well-regulated cannabis dispensaries. Because what they do offer is a model of control. What they do offer is an outlet of control. What they do offer is something that people can look and see and sometimes smell as an element. Right? As an element of control. It's something that they can see works. Now here's the next question. Who's medical? What's medical? What is medical marijuana mean in a world in which, you know, we're putting, what, tens of millions of young people and now older people on Ritalin and this and that and that and this, and people are on Prozac, you know, and is Viagra medicine? I guess it all depends where you're standing. I mean, you know, it's... In this world, when the pharmaceutical companies are increasingly doing this thing, when every time you turn on the TV, you know, I don't actually watch TV at home, but when I'm in hotel rooms, I turn on the TV, you flick channels, you know, and one commercial after another, you know, do you feel tired? Do you feel nervous? Do you feel anxious? Do you feel sad? Do you feel anything at all? Because we have a pill for you. We have a pill for you.
That was Ethan Nadelman from the Drug Policy Alliance at the 2006 Normal Conference in San Francisco. The 2007 Normal Conference in Los Angeles starts next Friday. There are still conference registrations available. Link up at normalaudiostash.com. Listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Make sure you visit our website at normalaudiostash.com. That's normalaudiostash.com for more information about everyday's show. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Thanks for listening today. See you at 4:20 tomorrow. Podcasting technology of Normal is made possible by Red Aphid Interactive Media. More information at redaphid.com.